The Capital Ideas podcast now has a new monthly edition hosted by Capital Group CEO Mike Gitlin. Investment professionals reveal their best mentors, how they find their next great idea, and a few funny stories. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. American Funds Distributors, Inc.
From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage. But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions, alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox President Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF.
Broadcasting across the globe, this is WBBR New York, Bloomberg 1130.
This is Bloomberg Daybreak here for this Monday, the 27th of March in London, coming up today.
Credit Suisse fallout. The chairman of Saudi National Bank resigns after comments to Bloomberg triggered the bank's collapse.
Discredited Suisse. The bank faces the prospect of a disciplinary proceeding.
The end in sight. Silicon Valley's assets are sold to First Citizens.
Martha Lane Fox on business investment, Twitter's source code leaks, and the risks of raising the state pension age. Those are the stories we're looking at in today's papers, and I'm Leanne Gerrans.
Plus, a test of metal, LME nickel, returns to regular trading for the first time in more than a year.
That's all straight ahead on Bloomberg Daybreak Europe. The business news you need to start your day in just one 15-minute podcast on Apple, Spotify, the Bloomberg Business app, and everywhere you get your podcasts.
Good morning from London. I'm Caroline Hepke.
And I'm Danny Berger. You're listening to Daybreak Europe. Let's get to some of our top stories. And we've had a lot of breaking news this morning. Among them, Amar El-Koudari, the chairman of Credit Suisse's largest shareholder, has resigned. Speaking in an interview with Bloomberg TV earlier this month, Al-Koudari said absolutely not when asked if Saudi National Bank would be open to further investments in Credit Suisse if there was another call for additional liquidity. Those comments helped spark a slump in the Swiss lender's shares and led to its takeover by UBS. He will be replaced by the Saudi National Bank CEO, Saeed Mohammed El-Ghamadi.
Now, First Citizens has agreed to buy all of Silicon Valley Bank's deposits and loans. SVB became the biggest U.S. lender to fail in more than a decade, and its collapse triggered a global banking crisis. Neel Kashkari, the Fed president, the Minneapolis Fed president, says that recent bank turmoil has boosted the risk of a U.S. recession.
What's unclear for us is how much of these banking stresses are leading to a widespread credit crunch. And then that credit crunch, you're right, just as you said, would then slow down the economy. This is something we are monitoring very, very closely.
Kashkari spoke to CBS after Bloomberg discovered that U.S. authorities are considering expanding an emergency lending facility to help prop up First Republic.
Credit Suisse is facing the threat of possible disciplinary action over how top managers ran the bank in the lead up to its collapse and takeover by UBS. Speaking to Swiss newspaper NZZ, FINMA president Marlene Amstead said, quote, CS has a cultural problem that translated into a lack of accountability. Adam Hay, Bloomberg finance editor, says the bank has a lot of questions to answer.
What's being mooted in this local report coming out over the weekend is essentially that there were some kind of fairly systemic failures by some of the top managers at Credit Suisse in various areas. And just to run you one quote from the FINRA president, which I think is quite telling of the extent of what they're thinking right now, is that, quote, often it was not clear who was responsible for what.
Adam Hay with the details there. Over the weekend, Switzerland's finance minister defended the government-backed takeover of Credit Suisse, saying the troubled bank wouldn't have lasted another day.
Now, the head of Britain's independent economic forecaster says that GDP is 4% smaller due to Brexit. The Office of Budget Responsibility Chairman Richard Hughes says that leaving the EU was a similar-sized shock to the pandemic.
We think that in the long run, it reduces our overall output by around 4% compared to had we remained in the EU. UK growth has been held back by a range of supply constraints on some of the key drivers of growth, We've lost around 500,000 people from the labor force. We've seen stagnant investment since 2016. And also our productivity has slowed dramatically since the financial crisis, not really recovered.
Hughes spoke to the BBC as the CEO of the UK's largest investor said that the UK has gone backwards in its efforts to level up the country. This is the legal and general boss, Nigel Wilson, who says that a series of shocks, sky-high inflation and a lack of investment have led to an historic fall in living standards for much of Britain.
The London Metal Exchange has resumed Asian hour trading of nickel contracts, marking a crucial step in efforts to repair the market. The metal opened for business at 1 a.m. UK time, more than a year after the LME suspended trading and cancelled billions of dollars of deals in response to a massive short squeeze.
And lastly, thousands of protesters have taken to the streets in Israel after the Prime Minister fired his defence chief, Benjamin Netanyahu, dismissed Yoav Gallant after he took to the airwaves to criticise a controversial plan to reduce the power of the Supreme Court. Speaking before events turned violent, Amit Pinchevsky, a journalism professor at the Hebrew University of Jerusalem, said that things need to change.
Netanyahu is not the issue anymore. It's bigger than him. It's bigger than everything, basically. It's not going to go back. We're not going to go back now.
Pinchevsky and others say that the judicial overhaul will concentrate too much power in the hands of the ruling party in Israel. Those are a few of our top stories this morning. Look, I think the Saudi fallout is incredibly interesting. Amar Al-Qadari, of course, it was Bloomberg's Yusuf Gamal al-Din who was speaking to Saudi National Bank in mid-March about whether or not they would increase their stake in Credit Suisse. And the response was quite a blunt no. It was known that that would be the sort of response, but somehow it caught the attention of investors. And it really did seem to trigger that sell-off.
Yeah, it's such a fragile market. So any comments are amplified. But look, the aftermath of that was S&B stake in Credit Suisse. About $1 billion was wiped out from it. We have some fantastic in-depth Bloomberg reporting that talked about how Gulf investors perhaps are more cautious towards investing in banking in general. So the ramifications of this, it does seem like there's been some scarring. And yes, this is just yet another ramification.
Yeah, absolutely. Bloomberg's Yusuf Gamal al-Din will join us a bit later on in the program to talk all of those issues through. Also, though, the other story that caught my attention, I don't know whether you've read it this morning, is around Jack Ma. So he's sort of in self-exile, effectively. And I think it's got a lot of people's attention because he's one of China's most recognisable business leaders. And Bloomberg has a story on the Terminal about how the Chinese government really would like him to return to make the sort of pitch for how the government is supporting private business. But there is still a huge amount of scepticism around that because of the kind of issue that Jack Ma faced after the big speech that he made in 2020 that criticised some regulators. And other high-profile CEOs. And yeah, so it's a very interesting piece.
There might be signs that maybe he's coming back to public life. This maybe isn't the strongest sign, but the South China Morning Post did report this morning that there was a Jack Ma sighting, specifically in Hangzhou. According to the paper, he was visiting a private school. He was seen in a car with the Alibaba CEO and executive vice president. That was enough to send Alibaba shares higher this morning. But again, just a Jack Ma sighting, not him speaking in public, but perhaps some signs that he's returned to China.
Yeah, absolutely. Very interesting. OK, let's get more on the bread and butter, the bank story. The news that First Citizens has agreed to buy Silicon Valley Bank, parts of it. The deal includes the purchase of about $72 billion of SVB assets at a discount of about $16.5 billion. Our markets reporter, Jan Patrick Barnard, joins us now for more. Do you think, Jan Patrick, this draws a line after the events of the past couple of weeks, now that the US has, you know, after some delay, wrapped up this sale of most of the business?
Very good morning. I'm not sure if I'm brave enough to say it's drawing a line under the whole story right now. But I would say it does support the sentiment. It shows that shows us that the whole episode was handled rather quickly from the regulator, from the government. They did not let us hang for too long and let jitters build into the market. So that's a good sign and probably helps confidence that should there be another bank that is getting into trouble, that there could be a quick solution for it.
And, you know, everyone wants a quick solution, but everyone is also looking out for where the next drama might unfold. Friday was really all about Deutsche Bank, the fears over there. I'm looking at TradeGate. It is up on the pre-market trade, just about 2.6%. But are we gonna be done with that Friday session? Are we gonna draw a line under it and say, okay, that was just some irrational market action?
I would say like Friday certainly had some irrational components to it. And I strongly rejected the notion that there is instability in the banking system because there was simply no evidence at all to show that. But what is certainly not over is the earnings story for banks. Banks have been everybody's favorite trade since October and even more this year, because everybody was feeling like, well, the higher rates are helping them. The economy is in good shape. The central banks are getting more in control of inflation. And now that story has flipped upside down, that we probably do get a recession in the US this year, that rates probably are coming lower, that banks might face some loan loss provisions going higher, and that will all eat into earnings. Refinancing maybe will be a bit more tricky for banks. And so I would say like that some of the moves in European banking shares that we have seen over the last couple of days do reflect those earnings concerns, and they will probably not go away or rebound very quickly.
Okay, thank you so much, Jan-Patrick Barnett, for being with us. Really good to have you on the programme. We'll be watching what happens with financials when we start trading in Europe in about 50 minutes. That is our markets reporter, Jan-Patrick Barnett. But I want to turn our attention then to the story around the Saudi National Bank chairman resigning.
Yeah, first let's get a reminder of what he said just mere weeks ago on the 15th of March.
The answer is absolutely not, for many reasons, outside the simplest reason, which is regulatory and statutory. We now own 9.8% of the bank. If we go above 10%, all kinds of new rules kick in, whether it be by our regulator or the European regulator or the Swiss regulator, and we're not inclined to get into a new regulatory regime.
That was, of course, the Saudi National Bank chairman Al-Qudari speaking to Bloomberg's Yusuf Gamal Al-Din just 2 weeks ago about Credit Suisse, really what kicked off all the turmoil of the bank. And this hour, we learned that Qudari has just stepped down. Yusuf joins us now. Yusuf, what do you make of this resignation?
Yeah, I mean, it's not a surprise. Sources that I've been speaking to said that was one of the scenarios that was being hashed out, and now it is official. Mohamed Al-Ghamdi, who is an institution within Saudi National Bank, very well known, he takes over as chairman. You cite personal reasons, and it's clear that the political capital that was put into play when they decided to go big on Credit Suisse late October, early November, that's been completely used up, and it was time to go. They put quite a bit of risk into this. Remember that, for them, it was not just about an opportunity. It was about creating synergies. It was about putting Saudi National Bank on the global arena to compete with other big banks. So there was a lot going into this, and clearly on the Saudi National Bank side, it was time to reset credibility, or try to at least, and regain investor confidence.
Okay, how badly hurt do you think that Saudi National Bank has been then from the collapse of Credit Suisse?
Here's the thing, they actually have not been hurt that bad. If you compare them to their peers, to other banks around the world in terms of valuations, the $1 billion loss, or a little bit in excess of that, on the Credit Suisse stake is not significant for Saudi National Bank. It's short of 4 billion Saudi riyals in terms of their size and in terms of the kind of deals they do. It's not significant, but it is more the credibility and future compromises they would have to make in terms of new deals. So no, there is no immediate impact or consideration that they had to play with that would lead them to that decision. I would not connect these two things. It's not that there was something that was falling apart at Saudi National Bank and that's why he had to leave. No, it was more about the audience, the global impact, and how far the story went as a result of his comments.
Yeah, and I mean, it's also incredible the speed at which it's went. I mean, you only talked to Al-Qudari 2 weeks ago. Reflecting back on that and everything that's unfolded, were you surprised by what he said?
Yes, I was. I was just as surprised as the market was. I mean, we weren't even sure that he would speak. I was on WhatsApp with him 24 hours before the interview. He looked like he might pull out at the last minute. So, you know, until 5 minutes before the interview, until he actually approached me and sat on the set, I wasn't sure this was going to happen. He knew that Credit Suisse would come up, you know, banks more broadly in terms of liquidity. But then he said what he said, and he said it with such conviction. You saw the market reaction. Within 15 minutes, we were down 15%. The rest, as they say, is history.
Absolutely. Mind you, you know, with change comes opportunity, I suppose. How could UBS revamp in the Middle East now that it's, you know, got Credit Suisse and all of the people that Credit Suisse actually has in the Gulf?
Yeah, I mean, they can cherry pick. So we understand there are about 40 investment bankers between Dubai and Riyadh and a couple of other spots. And they've built a strong reputation. They have a fantastic network of high net worth clients and royalty in there as well. And they made early progress in penetrating Saudi Arabia as a market. So UBS will sit down. We don't understand how much they've got to work with, but they have some top talent. And they're going to try and make use of that in terms of resetting the UBS tone. Because remember, UBS actually pulled out from much of this activity. So this would be a way to revamp and restart these operations in this part of the world, which for UBS sounds to me like it's only upside at this point.
What about sort of the other way around in terms of Gulf investments in European banks? Will this change the attractiveness of that proposition?
Yeah, it will. I mean, the Middle East investor base has had a very fraught relationship with European banks. I mean, despite it always being an amazing opportunity in terms of valuations, when push comes to shove a few years later, it turns out to have been a horrible investment. You think about what the Qataris did with Deutsche Bank, what happened in 2008 with some of the other stakes in European banks, and now with Credit Suisse. And we understand that the Qatar Investment Authority is actually reviewing much of its portfolio, its exposure to European banks. Maybe a broader shift is warranted. And what that could mean, as we understand it, is that you have capital coming out of European banks getting redeployed into completely different sectors, like tech.
Well, that is certainly one to watch. Yusuf, thank you so much for being with us. Bloomberg's Yusuf Gamal Al-Din there, speaking to us after the resignation of the Saudi National Bank chairman. Now up next, Martha Lane Fox on business investment, Twitter's source code leaked, and the risks of raising the state pension age.
Join Capital Group CEO Mike Gitlin for a new monthly edition of the Capital Ideas podcast. It's your look inside one of the world's largest asset managers. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Invest 30 minutes today. American Funds Distributors, Inc.
From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage. But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions, alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox president Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF.
Now, the paper review on Bloomberg Daybreak Europe. The news you need to know from today's papers.
So joining us now has been basically Anne Gerrans with a look at today's newspapers. The Financial Times says that Martha Lane Fox is warning UK policymakers of fragile business confidence. Now, here's an interesting name then.
Yes, indeed, Caroline. A name that many of us have heard before, and maybe this is your first time, but let's just get into what she says. Now, Martha Lane Fox is the new president of the British Chambers of Commerce, and she says big investment decisions are been held back, and that's due to political and economic uncertainty here in the UK. Now, speaking to the Financial Times, she says people just don't feel like taking risks, investing or thinking about international trade when they're still feeling anxious about the political situation and economy is putting them off taking these risks. And that's basically what she says. She does go on to say, though, that the Chancellor, Jeremy Hunt, you know, during his budget budget this month. He really made business investment such a priority in that. But she says they just need to do more work. Rishi Sunak's government need to come out, really, and do more, because she's saying she's talking to businesses all over the country, and it's clear from them that their confidence is still absolutely fragile. And she discusses the Labour Party and says a lot of business seem to be almost impressed with the Shadow Chancellor, Rachel Reeves.
Well, I do think it does feel to me, I'm not sure what you think, Danny, that there is a moment, right, where the conversation around Brexit and just the reality check that Brexit has done enormous damage to Britain's economy is actually now, as you know, no longer taboo. It was absolutely taboo for a number of years to say that, but the OBR saying it clearly.
The BOE saying it.
Yes. And I mean, you know, many, many city investors have said it for a long time, but it's not taboo. And I think that's quite pivotal for the next general election, maybe.
Oh, and it's harder to ignore when all other economies in Europe are back where we were pre-COVID, except for the UK.
And Martha also says it, ladies. Yes. Martha Lane Fox also says that basically she talks about Brexit and she says we're doing 40% less trade with Europe than we were before. So there we are. Yeah. She says that an astonishing large number.
So other stories hitting the papers. New York Times has a Twitter story about some leakages.
Yes, indeed, Danny. So parts of Twitter's source code. Now, this is the underlying computer code on which the social network actually runs and has been leaked online. And this is all according to a legal filing. A fraction of the code was posted on GitHub. Now, that's, of course, the online platform used by software developers. Now, one real big concern about this Twitter leak and this code getting out is that it could make security vulnerabilities really present, and that could give hackers the means to extract user data or actually take down Twitter as a whole. On Friday, Twitter sent a copyright infringement notice to GitHub. GitHub has complied and has taken down the code that day. But Caroline, of course, you know, Twitter seems to be facing a lot of outages and a few problems at the moment since the takeover on Elon Musk, and since he does try to find the balance when it comes to Twitter. But tech companies have become, you know, real targets for opportunist hackers and others. We've seen Microsoft and Google go through the similar sort of thing when it comes to vulnerabilities and hackers. Now Twitter apparently wants to know the identity of the user behind this leak.
Yeah, and I suppose the criticism around Twitter is whether it's to do with all of the personnel changes and laying off of so many kind of tech staff within the company. Lastly, though, pension age in the UK. The Times headline reads that raising the state pension age risks trapping millions in poverty.
Yes, and this is a piece by Paul Johnson. Now, he's the director of the Institute for Fiscal Studies, and he really discusses the latest political flashpoint, pensions. But Caroline, really more so in France, he argues, and he does try to relate it back to the UK and how we view pensions. And he basically says here in the UK, our state pension age is actually much higher. It's 66 and it's heading to 67 this decade. And then in 20 years, it's going to be 68. And really, there's been no backlash against it whatsoever. People have kind of just accepted this has happened. And he's arguing that things do change, in this case, projections of life expectancy. And it's good to remain flexible in the face of change, but he's saying it's really important that people know when their £10,000 pension is actually going to kick in so that they can plan for their retirement and also have this massive degree of confidence.
Yeah.
But he really talks about, you know, how changing the pension age is really going to push people into poverty because it's once again the unknown.
Yes. Paul Johnson, I mean, maybe, I mean, he is a perennial thorn in the side of this government. Obviously, he's very focused on poverty reduction, so I think that would be his defence. But yeah, I think maybe you could rename Paul Johnson's IFS something quite different.
But then he also does, you know, really discuss private pensions now and what that means, you know, for people who are just having state pensions.
Join us in Chicago or virtually on May 2nd for Bloomberg's Business Value of AI event and networking reception. This event will gather business and technology executives to share their experiences and provide insights into their strategies for deploying AI that achieves a desirable ROI. You'll also learn how companies have successfully implemented AI solutions that have improved productivity and profitability. This program is proudly sponsored by IBM. Register at BloombergLive.com/AI/radio.